Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Tricia Keffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida. I hope you enjoy the following interview, and if you have any ideas for books, please drop me a line on my website at plantspeoplelove.com. This is Tricia Keffer with New Books in Architecture, with a special mini-series in landscape architecture. I'm delighted to introduce today's guest, Bradley Cantrell. His new book is Codify, Parametric and Computational Design in Landscape Architecture. Hi, Brad. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tricia. How are you?
Oh, good. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm trained as a landscape architect. I've been in academia for the past about 15 years. My research and my work is primarily, as the topic of the book would probably lead you to believe, in the area of computation in the discipline. Primarily, my work in that area has been looking at different ways media changes our perception of the landscape. And it's gone from really looking at the workflows that we developed to kind of larger views of how media has changed our view of landscape and the environment. And in more recent times, really looking at the kind of physical computing aspect of that. So how computation is not only a way to make imagery or animations or things like this, but how different forms of sensing in the physical environment, from remote sensing to local sensing, might be a way that we begin to have a deeper attachment with environmental phenomena. I'm currently a professor and the chair of the Landscape Architecture Department at the University of Virginia. Before that, I was at the Harvard Graduate School of Design, where I was the graduate program director, and I also was the co-coordinator of the Master of Design in Technology, as well as the co-director of the Responsive Environments and Artifacts Lab. And then I'll say just one last thing. But before that, I was in southern Louisiana for almost a decade, where a lot of my research really kind of took hold, and kind of looking at large scale infrastructure on the Mississippi River and the southern Mississippi River Delta.
So, what was your motivation for writing this particular book?
So this book, one of the things I had done in the past with the past three books. The first two really looked at the tools we use and how they're applied. The second book, Responsive Landscapes, tried to lay out an idea about how this kind of physical computing realm is taking hold. And with Codify, it was really really about looking across the discipline. I feel like I've been around long enough that I've seen computation relegated to the side. And it's really, for many, many years, there's always a discussion. Is it better to draw by hand or is it better to use the computer? We've gone way beyond that discussion these days. And Codify was really a way to look out and do a survey in landscape architecture, see what people are doing in firms, in academia, in different venues, and bring that all together. And so part of that is, in each of the sections, it's really looking at how these technologies are applied, how they're changing our view of the world, and then also how we as landscape architects are actually creating the computational tools to lead us forward.
So, what is coding? Where did coding come from?
So coding is, it's really just the way that we create instructions right? For a computer, but you could think of it in many different ways. In this book, it's very much about computation itself and how computing or computers do that computation. And so coding is really just the development of that instruction set. How do we create the instructions that are then executed? I would say in some ways that's been a discussion in kind of multiple venues. One of it's about computation, and there's some kind of versions of this in the book, particularly in Leif Estrada's work and Ricardo Gonzalez's work, really thinking about how coding might be a rule set or a set of instructions that might guide our interface with ecological systems and infrastructure. So really the simplest answer is that it's just an instruction set, but I think in the book we try to expand that across different venues or different applications.
So it was interesting in a book you talk about how technology develops, and then, for instance, I was interested in Kodak. I had a professional portrait studio for 20 years, and how technology moved forward and then it takes a step back. Can you talk more about that? You know, we like move forward, and then how businesses can use this technology coming out of our programs.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of ways to think about that. One of them is, we're often, I would say, as a discipline in landscape architecture, we're often not the ones creating the tools. And so what we see oftentimes is there's a lot of, I'll use the word progress, but there's a lot of progress, kind of furious examination of a certain aspect of society, and a whole range of technologies just kind of, burst out of that. In some sense, what happens then, and I think this is what happened with, our move into digital media, is that we as a discipline take what we already know. And so if we think of kind of the original versions in terms of media, we essentially apply these technologies to become faster drafters, faster illustrators, being able to create more compelling imagery, more detailed document sets, and kind of engage in ever more complex projects. But there was never really this kind of paradigm shift in thinking with all of these new tools. And I would say that step back, we could call it a step back, but that step back is oftentimes about reflection. And it's somewhat generational, because we get to a point where an entire generation has been saturated in the tools. They don't know, or the technologies, they don't know a different version of the world. And then that step back is really a kind of reevaluation of where we're at. And then really trying, in some sense, being able to then reimagine the way those technologies are employed, or even what technologies might be missing. And I think a lot of the work I'm doing now, and a lot of the work that colleagues are doing now, is getting engaged in trying to understand what tools are missing. So I think for firms and for the for the kind of professional world, we see firms in many ways they completely embrace computation in one way or the other. I think we can still say that there's a place for the analog tools, but I don't know of many firms out there that aren't almost fully embracing digital technology. But I think one of the things we're seeing today is that we're at a place where many firms are also seeing the idea that they need to be the leaders. And so we see firms like Olin or Mahan Reichel or SWA actually developing their own research groups. And those research groups are then, some of it's about digital technology, but it's oftentimes about technology more generally, looking at ways these technologies are applied specifically in landscape architecture, how they might be used, and then in all of that, what is the kind of market area that gives these firms a competitive advantage?
Yeah, so you're kind of going forward and reevaluating, and then making it better as you go along.
Yeah, and sorry to interrupt there, but part of that is, yes, I think it's making it better. Part of it is also, even just, we get to a point where our thinking starts to shift, right? And because, if we've been using pencil and paper for 100 years, 30 years into kind of digital drafting, our thinking shifts. We're removed from those physical tools, so we're no longer trying to kind of emulate those old tools, But instead, that step forward is that paradigm shift I'm talking about. And that's one where, you know, the pencil is no longer the surrogate or the thing we're simulating in the computer. It's now all about the pixels, or it's all about the vector line work. And so I think that's that shift. And I would say it makes it better. We do lose something, but it also, you know, completely alters our way of interacting with the world.
Well, on a side note with that, you know, I changed careers and I went back to landscape architecture school. And of course I've used a mouse. Most of my, from high school on, I had a mouse in the house for the computer, but I went back to actually getting the pen tablet, and I found that actually I could work much faster, and I picked it up very quickly using that on my computer screen.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is a whole set of experiments we've been doing. And one of them is, you know, the extension of our mind to the end of our hand. Right. And, you know, whenever we then put the mouse in it, and then we also have the extension from the mouse back to the screen, I think that, you know, it's just a whole other level of mediation. And I think the pen tablet is definitely one of those spaces where, you know, one, it lets us feel comfortable from where we were to now, but it also gives us this, you know, connection with our body back to the input in the computer in a really tangible way. So, I mean, I think it's a good example.
Well, you know, leading to that, I like this example in the book, the sentence. It says, humans are complicated and hard to measure. So how can, as designers, how can we measure humans and how can we measure our design?
Yeah, I mean, measuring design is a pretty open question. And I would say the kind of quantification of, I mean, either human behavior or even kind of subsets of kind of human emotion, all of these things are, I think they're, you know, one, they're difficult. The other is we can do that in different ways. And in reality, I think it's the same way that we, you know, measure, the environment or ecological systems, and that's through abstraction. And so we're actually quite good at this. We create a version of humans, maybe idealized or not, but it's a very simple version. And we take those behaviors and we generalize them across, you know, the complexity of humanity. We see this in terms of managing environments. We simplify them and we build a set of rules for how we would manage them. And we look for that environment then to behave the way we want it to. And I would say we do something similar with human beings. One of the issues there is that is, you know, it essentially becomes another form of control. And in some sense, I think we always want to be careful there where we're not over assuming. So I think that one of the things many people are trying to do is how do we devise interactions between the abstract systems of computation and the complex systems of the physical world, right? And so, in some sense, if we build the models in the computer that then allow us to measure those environments, how do we not strip that complexity out of it? I don't have a definitive answer in that, but I think that's one that we're all struggling with always, right? Is how do we use these tools to promote the complexity we love in the world, the complexity of environment, of species, of ecology, also the complexity of just, you know, human interaction and human experience. That right there to me is the big project of landscape architecture and computation. How do we maintain that complexity while using these, you know, extremely powerful computational tools?
So in that chapter of the book, let's see, you're talking about syntax. What is syntax and how is it applied to the block scale you were talking about, and how can designers use that?
In terms of syntax? Mm-hmm. So in many ways, you know, when we're starting to talk about this idea of syntax, it's really about this, you know, this, what is the language? Like how do we understand the language? How do we, allow others to take part in that language through the syntax. And I think many of the examples we have in that part are really diving into, How it's being, how computation is being applied in the, in, you know, in the practice and in research, and what is the language of the that application. And so, I think in that chapter we have a piece by Chris Reed where he's talking about generative modeling, but across a range of scales from furniture to the city, and what are the languages in all of those scales. We have David Fletcher's piece on South Park, which is actually quite interesting because, you know, Fletcher Studio used a kind of reverse engineering process and really developed the parametric model as a representation of their more kind of analog explorations. And then, you know, Stephen Irvin in that one, I think, does a great job of really laying out one a history, and which is really great. But then also diving, you know, pretty deeply into what it means to have this this language, right, with the physical world and with computation as a mediator. And so that chapter on syntax is, you know, we think of it kind of broadly, but in all of those cases, it's really about what is the language of computation that we're engaging in, and then what are the results that we are getting from those different forms of language.
How were you using the syntax in your teaching studios?
So I think we do this in a couple different ways. One of them is looking, you know, so in the design studios, the one we taught just this last year, and I taught in coordination with Andrea Hansen and Brad Goetz and PhD fellows Zihao Zhang. In that studio, this idea of language or syntax, the way things are arranged, is really looking at sorry, if I back up for one second. In that studio, we're looking at the Central Valley in California, and really trying to understand as landscape architects how we might engage at the scale of a landscape like the Central Valley. It's diverse, but it also has, you know, some kind of hugely monolithic infrastructures that are controlling it. So in that sense, what are the ways that we can begin to use the tools that created the Central Valley, right? And that, when I say that, these are tools of that were used to model the hydrological systems, to control the infrastructure, to model the hydrology and the agriculture. How can we start to hack into those and develop a language or syntax that then begins to alter or change that kind of monolithic approach? And so in that way, in terms of the way we approach that, was really asking them to create forms of representation, so digital models, animations, some created board games, but really these ways of creating code or rules that we can then play out scenarios and then understand how different forms of intervention in the landscape could alter that larger scale system. In other courses, we're using it as this idea of the language just as ways to introduce computational thought. So in our kind of more basic courses here at UVA, we're using it as a way to structure the way we think when we're working in the computer, so that we understand the way code is developing the instructions for the tools we're using. We're not teaching coding itself in those courses, but really more how the computer is thinking, or how the computer is executing its instructions. Thinking is probably too much to give it. And then really getting them to understand that it's not just a collage we're making, but in reality the computer is computing all of these kind of elements, and the result is the image that we're beginning to create.
So, kind of to play on that, where does in the next section you're talking about perception, mm-hmm. And how we design sequences, systems, and patterns of our landscape. But then you're talking about play, and it's a powerful human, quoting, powerful human cognitive method for exploration within bounded space. How does play play into Codify?
Another good question. I mean, I think in that section on perception, the last piece in there by Robinson and Davis is, I think, most emblematic of that. And, you know, it starts off, I mean, that whole section starts off on kind of the landscape as the model, also forms of simulation that begin to change our perception of the landscape. And then, you know, in this last one, it's really, it really speaks to what I think is an important project for landscape architecture. And that is the construction of the interface that allows us to have access to these really complex computational tools on one side, and the complexity of the physical world on the other side. So in some sense, the project of representation that we've been engaging in for many years becomes even more important, because now we're creating this kind of oftentimes this real-time interface between these two realms. And so that interface is the one that, you know, it guides our perception. It changes the way we understand the environment around us, changes the way we engage it, how we want to, manipulate it. And so this idea of perception becomes extremely important. And, you know, that section starts off, as I mentioned, really looking at kind of two forms of that, the landscape as the medium itself and how we engage it, and then also ideas of simulation, and then agent-based models, and how each of those kind of sit out there as cases that are different ways we're using computation to begin to engage the physical world.
So what are the six, let me go here, the six solution space, I have to click over here for a second.
Yeah.
The six acronyms. Six acronyms. There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to have to pull this up here.
That's okay.
I mean, I think, you know, in that, I'm not going to be able to go back and remember all the six actions, but, you know, one of the pieces that I think is, once again, you know, so important there is that the creation of that that interface is a design project all in itself. And you know, in that on one side there's this kind of set of commonalities that are created that, you know, that it allows us to not only, you know, develop those commonalities in terms of interface with computation and the environment, but it also lets us you know, take on kind of human concerns and then kind of I won't even call them factual, but kind of data driven elements. So there's this idea that both the subjective and the objective can be addressed in some sense within this. So it's not computation just to begin to take on the kind of objective, what we usually assume is objective components, but also gives this kind of subjective nature. And I think that then creates this kind of more generative way of seeing the landscape, which allows us to actually engage it as designers and not as scientists or engineers. I think the other, you know, some of the other pieces in there is that the interface, when we talk about play, the interface also allows us to play. And the important aspect of that is that, you know, by simply engaging in it in a way that is about our curiosity as designers and our, you know, our, you know, a way to allow kind of the human aspect to come out of it, it becomes a really kind of important aspect of this idea that the interface itself is a project.
Is there room for emotional codify and aesthetic codify?
I think so. I mean, you know, I think, you know, once again, I'm not a huge fan of this idea that we need to kind of supplant kind of humanity through computation. And so this kind of aesthetic and emotional piece, while I think we want to engage it, I do think there's a point here where kind of the insertion of the human being and allowing for, you know, taste, culture, emotion to play a role is important. And I think, you know, I'd have to go back and look at Alex and Brian's piece, but part of that idea of the interface, you know, hits on that, right? Is that it's not just about the data. It is very much about kind of the human being in that equation.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And is it about like how we fit into like all these, you know, systems in the landscape?
I think it is, but I also think, in that, there's two things that we might be conflating here. One of them is this idea that, the idea that it's the tools that allow us to engage in new forms of, speculation or new forms of design. And the other is the actual use of computation to shape the world itself. And that those two things, I think somehow, oftentimes get kind of molded into one another. I think in Brian and Alex's piece, it's much more about the tools and the ways of engaging, like creating the tools that allow us to think of the world in new ways. And also to bring together these kind of complex areas of computation and ecology or environment. The other one is, how do we forge new, essentially forge new relationships with the environment? And part of that's, I think, a much slower process. It's one that is allows us to evolve alongside those new forms of engagement, and it's not really a new restructuring of the world, but instead it's little kind of moments that we begin to develop and use computation as ways to kind of curate or choreograph those relationships with the environment itself. I think this isn't in Codify, but with Earl Ellis and Laura Martin, we wrote a piece, a while back that really talked about, wilderness in this way, and the idea that, if wilderness is kind of a construct of our own perception of the world, how might computation play a role in that? And part of the way we talked about that there was that we might begin to think of the world, we're already altering it in very major ways. We still think portions of it are have this kind of wild aspect, but what if, in some sense, we don't even see the management anymore of the world or the control of it that we're imparting on it, and we get this new conception of a new, and essentially a different form of wildness.
Oh yeah, that's interesting. So how can we? Your next section was employ. So can we employ these tools to make a better environment or keep it wild, or what should we do?
Yeah. I think, yes and yes. I think, as landscape architects, we're always, I feel like we're always optimists. We are looking to always make the world better in one way or the other. I think part of that, I'm also an optimist about human beings overall. I think most disciplines are looking to make a better world in their own way. I believe deeply in the in essentially the kind of training we give landscape architects and how they see the world. So yes, I believe in most cases that's what we're doing. And I think the computational tools have already made overall a better world for human beings. One of the things that I think moving forward is that how do we extend that, and I'm using the word better in quotes here. How do we extend that idea of a better world for, a whole, all of the species that inhabit it? That's one of the things that I think we've been really remiss in terms of, kind of human beings on Earth, and the way we even use, computation or other kind of forms of design and control, we've really thought about, human safety, human comfort, human needs. And then we oftentimes, help or remediate those that we are, those whose worlds we're changing. And I think moving forward, we're moving to a place where computation, also just new forms of kind of, new philosophical frameworks. We're starting to see the world in ways that aren't just about human beings, that human beings aren't just the kind of the apex and everything else falls below that. But instead, we're just one of many actors. And it's a paradigm shift in the way we see the world. But it's also the tools we have are letting us see the world in ways that complexity, shows us that human beings aren't necessarily, the thing that needs to always be catered to. For a better world, maybe human beings sit somewhere, kind of in line with many of the other species. So yes, I think computation is helping to craft a better world, but it's through the outlook that landscape architects might have, as well as other disciplines.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because talk about like human beings, we're not the apex. I was talking with another gentleman. He's like, human beings in the span of the Earth's history, we're in a very, very small part of it, actually.
Yep.
We're just the last little tiny bit of the line. Mm-hmm. So we might not be as important as we think we are.
Right. Yep.
So how can we employ all these tools to make like a better community? Let's just say I'm here in Key Largo and we want to create some community centers, et cetera. How can I use these computational tools to design a better environment for not just, thinking about people, but what about the wildlife and the ecology and the water quality of the area?
Yeah. So, I think there's kind of short-term and kind of longer-term looks at the way we begin to use computation. I mean, in the short term, I think some of the more interesting ways we're using these tools are really about inclusion and engagement with communities. And I think in that sense, rather than oftentimes creating the platform so that everyone can be a designer alongside of us, what computation is often providing is ways that we can begin to visualize the complexities of say, a community, how people can be more informed about their actions in the kind of larger ecosystem of what it means to be part of a community, and then how that community can come to the table and be engaged with designers, policymakers, business leaders, so that they have their own power when they step up. And so I think that's that is a real kind of way computation is helping, and that's oftentimes through web platforms or even just ways that we're collecting data, having open access to data, all of those pieces. I think in the longer term, one of the things we're seeing is that, we're at a place where we need less, I would say, complex models to understand the world, and more, small scale experiments to begin to test out many of the kind of new ideas that are out there. And so, in that sense, I think computation plays a role because, not only does it allow us to make quick models, test them in the computer, but then once we begin to see their effects in the landscape, to begin to monitor those, visualize the data that's coming from them, understand the interactions humans and others are having with our design, our designs. And so I think on that end, this kind of longer term monitoring project that many firms are engaging in becomes another really important aspect of computation moving forward.
So we can do like just small scale experiments to see how effective our design ideas are playing out in the real world.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we've tried to do in the past is we've tried to make the perfect model so that we can then create the, I mean, I'm using perfect also, with a bit of hyperbole here, the perfect model to then create the perfect landscape or perfect community that then we maintain and keep the way it is, going into the future. Part of what I think we're understanding is that, there are, that doesn't really create kind of resiliency. And what we're really needing to do is to develop ways of intervening in the world that are, you know, maybe smaller in scale, that essentially the act of creating that intervention is part of the learning process of the design project. And that, you know, the intervention then allows us to see what happens and then create the next intervention. And so that could be something, you know, as small as, say, a community park, that then we understand kind of how people begin to use that space. And then, but built into that is the idea that park is going to evolve over time, right? And that it's not just about maintaining it in its kind of current form, but that space will be something for an evolving and changing community. But it could also kind of expand up to the scale of, say, watershed management. And that, you know, rather than trying to understand every single intricacy, you know, while we might have a model that gives us a general idea of how water will behave, we instead begin to employ smaller scale interventions, and those interventions kind of build on one another. And, you know, they might fail and we learn from the failure. They might succeed. We learn from the successes, but that then creates this, a space that is not so fragile and not so easily breakable by kind of a single unseen event.
So we can, you don't have to know everything. We just need to know enough to produce the results.
Yeah. I mean, in reality, of course we need to know something, but, right? But,
yeah.
But in the end, it's like, we'll never know enough anyways, in reality. And I think, you know, this is the kind of opposite version of the way we've been thinking about computation, but, you know, instead we act first almost. But we act first in a way that's at a small enough scale that that the failure of that action is actually is part of the learning process. And I would say in that, our ability to monitor, to observe the world through forms of computation, through forms of imaging, through sensing and monitoring, becomes a kind of real key piece to that idea. It's not just our observations that we see with our eyes and kind of measure physically, but it's this whole other set of data that starts to come up and allows us to kind of analyze our actions and in a way use that feedback to create the next action.
Well, I guess that kind of leads to my next question. So in your book, you're talking about a social ecologist. What is a social ecologist?
Boy, that's a hard question for me. And this would be, I would say that I'm going to give a really bad answer, and my faculty here probably at UVA would kill me for it. But you know, essentially, you know, social ecologist is looking at the relationships in society, right? Like how do communities, how do individuals interact with one another to create these kind of robust human ecologies? And so so in that sense, I think, you know, that the one way to look at that is taking our kind of longstanding work in kind of the ecological sciences and now applying that to kind of human behavior and human interactions. I think it becomes a good model for us to understand the kind of interconnectivity of our society. So on that end, you know, the kind of social ecologist is often using computation, often using many of the same models in computation to understand human society. But once again, I think it plays into the same space that I was talking about earlier. It does become very much about abstracting those relationships, and it kind of removes us slightly from the actual interactions themselves.
So I'll go on to an easier question. You talk about fluid hierarchy. What is a root hierarchy and versus a fluid hierarchy?
Say that again.
You're talking about here about a fluid hierarchy in design and a root hierarchy. Can you talk about the difference between those two?
I mean, so part of that is, you know, kind of if we look at many of the ways that we set up hierarchies to understand the world. The idea of the those two forms of hierarchy is, you know, one is ever shifting, essentially, right? That there is no real top to it. There are moments where, you know, there is kind of one thing driving the system, but that that may shift to being the kind of recipient of a new hierarchy at other moments. So I think part of that sees the world less about developing the kind of hierarchical structure and then maintaining that, but instead, you know, using those two forms of hierarchy, particularly this kind of more dynamic version, as a way to understand that, you know, at any moment within a hierarchical structure, that there may be these kind of shifts in terms of what is the main driver essentially.
So in your final chapter, you talk about, you know, design for a mind with many bodies. How do we do that?
Yeah. So I think, you know, in that last piece that Ricardo wrote, one of the really amazing things about some of that work, and it's extremely, extremely nascent. And so it's just like, I think it's kind of another new approach, but part of that is that rather than, once again, developing this kind of upper, like this satellite view of the world that then allows us to manage it, that in many cases, the mind with many bodies is that there is a way of engaging in much smaller ways to, so like smaller interactions with the physical world that then enact a larger change. And so the mind with many bodies is the concept that we have these multiple interactions occurring, kind of small, like, so for something like, a change in a hydrological system, we might have kind of small, very small infrastructure that is engaging the water column to affect turbidity, to change kind of dissolved oxygen content. But they're behaving based on their interaction with that very local space, rather than some larger controlling infrastructure that's trying to manage the entire system. So that idea is that the intelligence is distributed, as opposed to it being the one, you know, the one kind of entity behind, you know, overviewing everything and then making the decisions. How we get there, I think that's something that is, once again, comes back to this idea of prototyping and experimentation. It's really about a different design paradigm. It's not one that once again asks us to survey the world in extremely high detail, take that information, analyze it to the nth degree, create a model of our design, and then implement it. But instead, it really is the idea that we would, kind of like Julian Raxworthy would put out there, that we're essentially gardeners of the world, even at the largest scales, and that we're using computation in that fold as a way to extend our own sensorial abilities and become, I would say, even more complex in our in the way that we're essentially beginning to design those interactions. So it's, you know, gardening seems like a very kind of simple way to put it, but the way that, you know, Raxworthy would put it would be that it's really this continual interaction, right? And that there is no, you know, while there may be a goal, it's always assumed that the landscape is going to be changing, and that our interaction with that is really about guidance and a reciprocal kind of learning and feedback between humanity and other species, other forms of matter, et cetera.
Well, let me ask you: do you have a favorite software to codify design with?
So in terms of software, I mean, I'm at a place where I feel like I'm kind of old school these days.
Really?
I'm especially with, you know, working with all of my students, they seem to be, you know, every year getting, you know, farther and farther ahead of me. I'm still a fan of kind of 3D modeling and animation software. So things like 3D Studio Max and After Effects. In terms of, you know, creating representations of the world that are animated, but also very much about a story. On the other end, part of what I'm really enjoying these days is just diving deeper into programming itself. And so in that sense, trying to imagine what's missing from all of these tools that we're using. And so using programming language like C# as a way to then begin to develop these kind of interfaces to see data in new ways, to develop kind of real-time connections between sensors and the models that we can create from them. So on one side, it's the kind of very base level, taking me all the way back to my early computer science days of coding. And on the other side, it's this kind of media end of being able to create animations, movies, and stories, which I think, I don't know if they go hand in hand anymore for me, but they give me kind of two ways of accessing different portions of my, the way I think about computation.
Is the new software, is it giving us new information, or is it just a different way of doing the same thing?
I think this is what you know, in terms of this book, what I'm trying to put out there, that it's actually, there are new ways of thinking about the information. It may be very similar information that we're bringing in, but we are now able to alter it, process it, and see it in new ways. And that is the kind of paradigm shift that we're in, is that we're trying to really understand what that means for us as landscape architects. So, many of these tools, even kind of these simple tools like Rhino, which is a 3D modeler, and Grasshopper, which is this plugin for that, which gives us the ability to, essentially create these associative models and some forms of visual programming. It's giving, young designers access to the way computers think, which is something that, I had access to many years ago when I first started out, because I needed to actually do programming. But then for a long time, it just disappeared. We essentially black boxed that. And with programs like Photoshop or AutoCAD, we kind of got rid of that understanding of how the computer is thinking. And so now I think we're kind of getting back to that area, which is changing. I mean, it's really changing the way we see the world around us.
The computers, they're only as good as how we can program them.
Yep. I mean, and I think this is my push, at least in the last 10 years, has been that it's not enough for us to sit back and wait for the computer scientists to create the tools that they think we want, but instead we need to know enough that we can engage them in ways that are that aren't naive, but at the same time allow us to be landscape architects guiding the computer scientists to help us create the tools we need. So we need to know just enough, right? We need to know just enough about how computers work. We need to know just enough about how code is executed, and then begin to imagine how those tools might evolve so that we can take on many of the issues that we hold dear to our heart as landscape architects.
Do you think that programming involves imagination?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, there's no doubt about that in my mind. I mean, I think you can look at, while much of programming, I would say, has been put to, well, in like our collective consciousness has been put towards, business, ways of creating new forms of business. There's just so much imagination in that realm, but it's all for kind of one purpose. And that is typically, a model to attract funding. So these kind of, startups and things like this. But in terms of, imagination and design, coding is just another way to, once again, abstract the world, and then use that as a new way of seeing the world. So yeah, coding is definitely full of imagination.
Well, Brett, I'd like to thank you for being here today. It's been an honor and a pleasure to speak with you about this book. This is marvelous. Can you tell our audience, what are you working on now?
So now, we're, I didn't say this at the beginning, but Adam Meckes is my co-author on this book. He's been at Design Workshop for many years. Adam is kind of working on his own projects. I'm basically beginning to develop a research agenda here at UVA, along with many others here at the school, as well as some of my PhD students. That's really looking at a research center and a set of labs that begin to create the platform for us to do exactly what I'm talking about, and that is a way for us to engage computation, engage these new forms of technology, and guide the creation of the tools that we, you know, that I believe we need, you know, moving forward. So, you know, I'm not in, you know, involved heavily in the kind of research at the moment, in my new role as chair. But it's definitely one that's a role that's about helping guide others and get the resources for them so that they can take this project forward.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Well, again, thank you so much for being here, and we look forward to seeing more research from you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you for listening today. This is Tricia Keffer with New Books in Architecture with a special mini-series in landscape architecture. If you have any ideas for books, please drop me a line. You can reach me through the American Society of Landscape Architects in the Florida chapter website. And again, have a lovely day.